The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا ادعوا ربكم تضرعا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories: Israeli forces detained several Palestinian protesters in occupied Jerusalem on boats after using force to disperse them for raising Palestinian flags. Fresh anti-racism protests erupt in the U.S. city of Chicago in the wake of last month's fatal police shooting of a teenage Latino boy. Also in the headlines, the second wave of the coronavirus pandemic has battered the healthcare and economy of Kashmir. We'll have a report. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Our top story: scuffles have broken out between Israeli forces and Palestinian protesters in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds amid tensions over restrictions on Ramadan gatherings. Clashes erupted when Israeli forces waded into protesters raising the Palestinian flag and detained several of them. Israel has tightened restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Jerusalem al-Quds since the start of Ramadan, launching a crackdown on protests against the Kurds. Over 100 Palestinians have been injured during the clashes. Anger has also spread to other areas, sparking protests in the occupied West Bank.
The Palestinian Authority, along with different political factions, held Israel fully responsible for the serious deterioration in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds over the past few days and called on the international community to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its provocations. Israeli police and settler violence erupted in the area on Thursday night and continued through Friday, leaving over 100 of Palestinians wounded and scores more arrested.
And since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, Israeli forces had been escalating measures against the people there, starting by cutting off loudspeakers of Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's why our people in Al-Quds are protesting and rising against oppression and crimes by the Israeli regime.
But the issue is not only between the Israeli police and the Palestinians. Since the start of the holy month of Ramadan, every night hundreds of Israeli settlers rush to the streets of the holy city and assault Palestinians under the protection of the Israeli forces. The extremist settlers chant death to Arabs during their marches. Hundreds of ultra-nationalist Israelis marched through central Jerusalem towards the Damascus Gate, which police had barricaded as a precaution.
Verbal condemnation of Israel over the aggression is not enough. The Palestinian factions must offer all forms of support to Al-Quds and its residents. Palestinians must stand united behind Al-Quds. What's going on is an uprising, and here in occupied West Bank, protests and demonstrations should continue. This is the least we can do to defend Al-Quds.
Palestinians say Israeli police want to prevent them from saying their prayers and the usual Ramadan evening gatherings at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and outside the Damascus Gate.
Protests which flared up in Jerusalem Al-Quds have now spilled over to the occupied West Bank in defense of the Holy City and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians warned that Tel Aviv is heading towards a heavy-handed crackdown against them in the occupied territories to ward off another surge in Palestinians' protests and anger. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Well, the Yemeni army says it has conducted a retaliatory drone attack on an airbase inside Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Sari said a Qasif 2K drone targeted the King Khalid airbase in the southwestern city of Khamis Mushait. The spokesman added that the attack was in response to Saudi Arabia's escalation of aggression and continued siege of Yemen. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have stepped up their retaliatory attacks against the kingdom in recent months. They're pushing for the lifting of the blockade on Yemen and an end to the war that has killed tens of thousands of people in the Arab nation. Journalist and political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti says Saudi Arabia uses the King Khalid airbase to conduct raids against Yemen.
The Yemeni army in the last 3 to 4 months has focused most of its attack against Saudi airbase, especially south of Saudi Arabia, on Khamis Mashit airbase. This is one of the largest airbase inside Saudi Arabia, and it's located in Asir province, south of Saudi, and is one of the closest and largest airbase close to Yemen, and it was one of the main base that's used by Saudi Arabia to target Yemen and as well to force the blockade on Yemen. And I just want to mention that every now and then we see that sometime Yemeni army here in Sana'a target, as an example, Abha Airport and Najran Airport and Jizan Airport, and those airports actually close to Yemeni border as well, and they considered as a civilians airport. But because when Saudi actually is using this airport as a military base or to conduct attack and strike against Yemen, we see definitely a direct attack against this airbase.
Americans in Chicago have taken to the streets again, calling for changes to the city's policing after last month's fatal shooting of a teenage Latino boy. The protesters gathered at Daley Plaza in downtown Chicago before marching through the streets. Several such protests and vigils have been held since 13-year-old Adam Toledo was killed. A body camera footage showed the officer shooting him shortly after the boy dropped a gun and raised his hands. The killing comes amid growing racial anger over police killings of African Americans in the country. Just recently, jurors found a former white police officer convicted of killing George Floyd by kneeling on his neck. While the victim was pleading, he could not breathe.
While many in America are celebrating an extremely rare murder conviction for a police officer for the killing of George Floyd, demands for police reform are only growing louder. Police in the United States kill about 1,000 people every year, so there's no chance the issue will go away. This month in Chicago, the nation's third largest but deadliest city, a 13-year-old boy was killed by police even though he clearly had his hands up in surrender. Eliminating systemic racism in law enforcement and implementing criminal justice reform is being demanded in the streets and in newspaper headlines, but tax money continues to be invested in more guns and war materiel. The combined spending of America's state and local budgets on police would rank as the world's third largest military expenditure. last year, the city of Chicago received $500 million in discretionary spending from the first major federal stimulus package. $300 million were handed to the city's police department instead of going to build the public health systems in communities devastated by the pandemic.
That's disgusting. That's not where the CARES Act money was supposed to go. There are communities, vulnerable and marginalized communities, that are not having basic needs met, while the CPD gets the newest, shiniest equipment. And that's just not right. Our demand up front right now today is to promise to have a public discussion to reassess and redistribute that money.
New President Joe Biden openly opposes defunding the police, but many hoped that with an executive order, he would at least place limits on the transfer of military equipment to local law enforcement. That hasn't happened. The Security Reform Policy Institute found that the flow of military gear has been faster under Biden than under Donald Trump.
Fundamentally, as in American cultures, we are reactionary. We don't like to deal with the root of a cause. What we need to do is think about why and how we can fix these solutions from a fundamental level. Education, mental health resources, and in general, affordable housing, public transportation. Anything that we can do to fix the foundational level, sure, it's going to take us longer. Sure, it's a longer process with the communities, lots more discussion, but that's the only way these problems will truly get solved.
The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act was approved by the House of Representatives in March, but it is not expected to be approved by the upper chamber Senate. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
We don't get it!
The second wave of the coronavirus pandemic is wreaking havoc in Indian-administered Kashmir. This is both in terms of healthcare and economy, in an area where, as you know, tourism is a major source of locals' income. Our correspondent, Shahanabad, brings us a report from Indian-administered Kashmir.
The Indian-administered Kashmir has seen a surge in coronavirus cases in times with the rest of the country. The pandemic was almost brought under control in February in the region. But within weeks, the numbers have swollen again to around 18,000 positive cases. Healthcare experts equally blame Kashmir's administration and locals for the spike. Despite the risks, the administration in Kashmir allowed and organized spring festivals. They were attended by thousands without following precautions, leading to a resurge in coronavirus cases. And to worsen things, tourists' inflow to Kashmir went unchecked. Kashmir has hardly witnessed normalcy since August 2019, when India unilaterally stripped the region of its autonomous status. Now, amid the second wave of the pandemic, fresh tensions are expected as new lockdowns would collapse the region's economy. Farooq Ahmed Shah, a hotelier, is discussing the ongoing situation with his staff. He's worried, but not for himself.
We have witnessed back-to-back lockdowns. Unfortunately, we do hiring every year, but with no time, we have to lay off. I'm not much worried about my business. But for these young men who have no source of daily income or savings that can sustain them in tough times, Kashmir's economy has always been suffering. But since 2019, Kashmir is witnessing horrible times and people are forced into poverty.
Kashmir's economy is dependent on tourism and agriculture. This year, the region witnessed year-long bookings in advance. However, the new wave of the pandemic in India has triggered panic and cancellations.
The pandemic since 2020 has 100% affected us, but, you know, from November, the tourism started reviving, and December mid onwards, it was getting better, and from January, Kashmir was 100%, almost 100% packed. If not 100, but 80% for sure. So since March ending, you know, due to the surge in cases across country, the tourism is coming down again. It is a huge loss for the industry.
However, Shamim and many others like him are more worried for Kashmir's health infrastructure. They fear a looming disaster if the coronavirus situation is not taken seriously.
With more than 18,000 active coronavirus cases in Jammu and Kashmir, the administration of this conflict-torn region is at a crossroads. The question is whether to impose a lockdown and face its economic consequences or endanger people and overload the fractured health sector. To break the chain of infections, the administration is trying its best. However, the people also have to act responsibly. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Well, India has broken the global record of daily coronavirus infections for the fifth straight day as it registers nearly 353,000 new cases. India's total number of COVID-19 infections has now breached the grim milestone of 17.3 million. The country has also registered its highest daily record of fatalities with over 2,800 new deaths. Several countries have pledged to send medical aid to help India tackle the crisis. Hoarding oxygen and vital medicine in homes is worsening the situation. That is while hospitals are overwhelmed with patients in major cities and many face a shortage of oxygen supplies and beds. Officials blame the spike on public reluctance to social distancing and other health protocols. Iran is initiating the final stage of a local COVID vaccine dubbed Coviran. This as the country is grappling with the fourth wave of the pandemic and is scrambling to vaccinate its citizens as soon as possible. Our very own Youssef Jalali brings us more.
Coviran is inching closer to the market. The Iranian-made vaccine kickstarted the third human trial phase after proving safe and effective against the virus in previous trials. The third phase will involve injecting the jabs to a statistical population of 20,000 volunteers. Developers say they're certain that the vaccine provides immunity of up to 70% against the coronavirus. But it's only after the third phase that an accurate figure can be achieved.
Already we have achieved the figures, but because we want to have more figures, so in third clinical trial stage you have to go for more, people to vaccinate. And that's why in third phase, we include more people, like 20,000 in compared with 200 or 280 in second phase.
The headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, which is in charge of Coviran's development, says it has already launched the production lines of the vaccines due to emergency.
Coviran factories are built in two phases. The first phase, which is complete and ready for use, has a capacity to produce up to 3.5 billion doses of Coviran jabs each month. The second phase, which is under construction, will produce 15 million doses per month. Both will work in full swing once we receive the necessary permits in almost 2 months.
Coviran works based on an inactivated coronavirus. Its developers say lab results indicate that it's also effective against new variants of the virus. Other than Coviran, Iran is working on 7 other homegrown vaccines, each based on a different platform to immunize the human body against COVID-19. This as the country has already started vaccination of the most vulnerable groups, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V. Once the third phase is over, Coviran will be the first ever Iranian-made COVID vaccine that makes its way to the market. This as Iran is grappling with the fourth and most lethal ever wave of the pandemic, which has put biotech firms in a race against time to get their jabs to the mass production stage. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
The United States has started to pull its military forces out of Afghanistan after nearly 20 years in that country. Commander of the U.S.-led coalition in Afghanistan, General Austin Scott Miller, confirmed that Washington had begun to withdraw troops from the country in local areas. The top general, however, added that the official date to begin the troop withdrawal would be the 1st of May. U.S. President Biden recently announced that he would pull American forces out of the Asian country in the coming months. This comes as U.S. troops were scheduled to have fully withdrawn from Afghanistan by May of 2021 under a peace deal signed between the Taliban and the administration of former U.S. President Trump. The Taliban accused Washington of violating the provisions of the agreement. Political commentator Madame Sarah Flounder says the presence of U.S. troops in Afghanistan has been a disaster for the people there, as Washington failed to improve conditions for anyone.
Well, this certainly ranks as a disaster at every stage from beginning to end, and it always has been a disaster for the people of Afghanistan and for the soldiers here who were sent to fight. And it was never intended to be anything but U.S. domination, strategic control of a country that's potentially fabulously rich in resources. They did want control of those resources. They've utterly failed. And they failed to make any improvement in the conditions of life for anyone in Afghanistan. It's poorer today after 20 years. Literacy rates, infant mortality, and including conditions for women. Overwhelmingly, where 80% of the population lives in the countryside. So things aren't better. They failed on every count, but they made a lot of money. And that is absolutely true. The weapons contractors, the military contractors, and that is what they intend to continue, even with all the talk of withdrawal.
Well, that's it for me.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The all-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee. the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. According to the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, the beginning of Ramadan is God's mercy, its middle is God's forgiveness, and its end is freedom from the fire of hell. It is the best period for attaining proximity to God. It is the month in which the doors of the divine mercy is open, for sure. Paying attention to God and connecting with that infinite source of greatness and power will have innumerable impacts in our life. God will not abandon his servant who has been remembering him. God says in Ayah 152 of Surah Baqarah, "Remember me and I will remember you, and thank me and do not be ungrateful to me." The sixth infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam, Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "God said, O son of Adam, remember me in your heart so that I too will remember you. Remember me in solitude so that I will remember you in solitude. Remember me in public so that I will remember you better in public. No servant remembers God among people unless God remembers him among angels." Remembrance of God causes one to abide by religious principles and teachings and to observe halal, that are permissible acts, and haram, that are forbidden acts. Some think that remembrance of God means repetition of the phrases Subhanallah, Alhamdulillah, and so on. Although this verbal remembrance is useful, true remembrance of God means to stop when facing a forbidden act so that one does not commit a sin. Islam has highly emphasized on the health and cleanness of the mouth and teeth. According to the injunctions or laws of fasting, none of the things that are done by a dentist for health of teeth nullify fasting. In other words, injection, pulling out, or filling the teeth will not nullify fasting. However, the effects of these works may nullify fasting, such as swallowing blood. Thus, it is better to go to the dentist after iftar. So, as far as nothing goes down the throat, fasting will not be nullified. Moreover, according to many ulama, injection of anesthetic will not nullify fasting. Altogether, any treatment of teeth that leads to bleeding is makruh or disapproved, as there is the likelihood of nullifying fasting. Toothbrushing during the day is permissible for a fasting person, provided that he does not swallow the saliva. Moreover, he should wash his mouth to remove the toothpaste completely. If a fasting person has filled his tooth, but the tooth bleeds during the day, he can swallow it if it is overcome by the saliva, and it will not nullify his fast. Also, a person whose gum bleeds several times a day, he cannot swallow the blood intentionally, but if he swallows it unintentionally, it will not nullify his fast. And in the last part of this episode, we are going to whisper a supplication that is called Du'a-e Hajj or Hajj supplication. This supplication is recommended to be recited every day in Ramadan. This supplication has been narrated by Muhammad ibn Ya'qub Kolayni in his book, Kafi. Kolayni was one of the greatest narrators of hadith among Shias. He was such a great scholar that both Shias and Sunnis have remembered him with high esteem. He has compiled the book in 20 years. Now, let us recite Du'a-e Hajj or Hajj supplication. O God, definitely I seek my need by you and from you. Anyone who seeks his need through others, but I seek my need from you. You are the one, there is no associate for you. And I ask by your grace and satisfaction to bless Muhammad and the progeny of Muhammad, and make for me in this year a way toward your sacred house, an appropriate, accepted, clean, and pure Hajj for you, so that it will brighten my eye and exalt my degree, and provide me sustenance to close my eye and keep my chastity and refrain from all your forbidden acts, so that there will be nothing more preferable to me than obeying and fearing you and performing what you like and relinquishing what you dislike and prevent. And make all of these in ease and amplitude and health and what you have blessed for me. And I ask you to make my death being killed in your way under the flag of your prophet alongside your friends. And I ask you to kill your enemies and your prophet's enemies by me. And I ask you to ennoble me through humiliating whoever you wish among your people, and not humiliate me through ennobling any of your friends. O God, make for me a way with the Prophet. God suffices for me, and whatever God wishes will be.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kaveh Tahlai. Just a couple of weeks ago, we covered the 10-year war anniversary of the war on Syria. Now it's time to cover another brutal U.S.-backed war, and that is the war on Yemen. It is now 6 years old. This is what Yemen's economy looked like before the war. From the year 2000, we took a look up until the year 2018. As you can see, the economy was actually not doing that bad. It had a GDP growth of between 6 to 8%, but you can see the dip there. That is when the war broke out, roughly around the year 2014, and it went all the way down to minus 28%. Pretty bad. I mean, this actually is a brutal war. Bombs are doing the killing on both the civilians and the economy. But the country itself actually, before the war began, was not doing well. It was a poor country. Living on less than $2 a day accounted for 45% of the population, 33% living on less than $1 a day. So you can see that this country was affected deeply by poverty. Okay, it is no surprise then that this kind of devastation, the war that the country has been inflicted on the country, well, there are many aspects of the economy that have grinded to a halt as a result. One common denominator that reflects the dire straits of the economy is the collapse of the Yemeni rial, the focus of our next report.
Cashiers sort through large stacks of money. Yemen's central bank has become another front line in this war. The bank's headquarters was moved from the capital Sana'a in the year 2016. The government not recognized, but the Yemenis accused the legitimate government of Yemen, the National Salvation Government, that it was using its resources to finance the war. But this was just another effort by the Saudis and its allies to squeeze the Yemenis. The relocation of the bank made the situation worse, since it divided the country. As one analyst put it, it left the country with two parallel centers of fiscal policy dealing with one currency.
Time to begin our first guest of today's show. Her name is Judith Brown, and she is the former manager at UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. She was the manager at Refugee Health Project in Yemen until the year 2001, and she also has a Facebook page on Yemen, which is good to see. Judith, welcome. The destruction of Yemen is something that is truly devastating and shocking. When we take a look at the way that the Saudi bombing campaign has happened for 6 years, I mean, this country was a poor country to begin with, and you have an economy that's in tatters. And the bombing campaign is said to have targeted vital infrastructure, which is my focus on this question, roads and hospitals, for example. Was that done with the aim of actually destroying the economy so that the people would rise up against the National Salvation Government there, do you think?
I think that one has to say that the Yemen economy has been targeted in many ways from the beginning, not only by bombing campaign, but by the embargo, by the movement of banks, by restriction of money in North Yemen. And yes, it has, in fact, I think one of the things that you didn't mention is its particular attack on the agricultural industry, everything to do with its markets, farms, animal livestock, warehouses, factories that produce food. They've all been targeted by the Saudi campaign, and that's been quite well documented, and certainly it has had the result of Yemen's economy being totally destroyed. I think that was it on purpose? I think my own feeling is that that was a target, because I think that modern warfare doesn't aim to necessarily win wars, but to destroy companies and keep those countries in a perpetual state of war.
Indeed, that could be the case. Thank you, Judith. We're going to definitely come back to you a little later in this program. Well, it's time to take a look at our second report of this program, which takes a look at one of the consequences of this war, food insecurity and its impact on the national economy.
A hungry child, malnourished due to prolonged lack of food. shortages of water.
Central bank is out of money. The price of the basic food basket, the things you need as a family in order to survive, has increased by 30% in just the past few weeks alone, and is continuing to increase. These are the same sets of factors that drove the country to the brink of famine 18 months ago.
The world has failed the Yemeni people.
Now, to seize this chance to revitalize the political process that we now hope we can see in front of us.
But the will of the Yemenis is still there as they welcome the holy month of Ramadan. Sana'a residents said they gave the Muslim holy month a great reception. People have flocked to the supermarkets for their Ramadan needs. However, not all Yemenis are as lucky as in the legitimate capital, Sana'a, run by the National Salvation Government. Yemenis see them as the legitimate governing body of the country. They have pledged a commitment to them.
Our guest for this section is Mia Shua. She earned her PhD in political economy from the University of Sydney and has written many articles, one of them titled Revisiting Neoliberalism and Democracy in a Time of Crisis. Mia, welcome to the program. Yemen is said to be so broken that it can never be put back together again. Take the Yemen Central Bank, for example, split into two by the self-proclaimed president of Yemen, Abra Matahari. That's resulted in trades at one rate in the National Salvation Government-controlled capital like Sana'a, and then another rate in SDC-controlled Aden. That's the Southern Transitional Council. Basically, this seems to be an effort to break the country into two parts. Is that what the aim is?
The fragmentation of state institutions is an unfortunate but expected outcome of this ruthless war. You could argue that the government's efforts to hold on to power and suffocate the Houthi movement at all costs has perpetuated this fragmentation and intensified it. The relocation of the bank is part of a government plan to bring the banking system in Yemen under the control, under its control, and deprive the Houthis of millions of dollars acquired from taxes from Sana'a-based banks and mobile operators. The president's move sparked an economic war between the two banks, as the Houthis refused to pay salaries of public servants in areas under their control and banned banknotes printed by the Yemeni government in Aden. It was said that the cuts in salaries had a severe economic toll. However, despite the Yemeni government efforts to control the exchange system, the Yemeni rial on Thursday moved towards a new record low in the government-controlled areas.
Okay, thank you, Mia. That's Mia Shua with her thoughts there. So it's time to take a break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up, so stay right where you are. Let's welcome back guest Judith Brown, the former manager of UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Judith, we're going to take a look at the port city of Aden and my question here, which is under Saudi Emirati siege, not letting the flow of goods freely into the country. The Saudis and its allies, they are not capable of winning this war. Why don't they settle for a political solution instead of destroying the country, placing a siege on Aden, and continuing this war in which they are not only losing, but they're choking the economy as a result?
Well, I think that one of the things is that as powers outside Yemen don't seem to want Yemen to end the war. Certainly, I think that when Trump was in power, he saw the possibility of selling a lot of weapons to Saudi Arabia. Biden came in making a great grand statement that he was going to return Yemen to peace, but in fact has done absolutely nothing except return the situation back to the same situation as Obama, i.e. he's not selling precision weapons, and he's talking about ceasefires, he's talking about peace talks, none of which have happened, and I can't see that they're going to happen. I know that a lot of people in the north of Yemen, they say to me that this is a proxy war, in as much as Saudi Arabia is fighting on behalf of UK and USA. I think there's a lot of truth in that, in as much as I think that the powers outside Yemen seem to have their own interests in keeping wars going across the whole of the Middle East, and keeping those countries destabilized for whatever reason, I'm not sure. But instability is a feature of war at the moment, wars without end that seem to go on forever. And I don't think that that the situation is one where there seems to be any urgency in the Biden camp, apart from making a statement, one of his first statements that he made when he first came to office. There doesn't seem to be any urgency in him implementing anything that's likely to create peace. And of course, ironically, one of the ways that you could stop outside parties from interfering in Yemen is by stopping the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia and UAE that are perpetuating the war in Yemen.
All right, that's Judith Brown there with her thoughts. Now let's go to the port city of Aden, which I mentioned, and see how Yemenis are actually faring there, because Aden is a port city. It should be doing okay. But the Saudis and the Emiratis have placed an embargo on that city.
The port city of Aden, key in the distribution of goods to the entire country, may be one reason why the UAE and Saudi Arabia placed a blockade on the country. Even that coalition failed, called a war within a war. A reported five-fold spike in deaths started the year 2021. Reasons? From COVID-19 to a variety of diseases, including hunger and cholera. This is one way Yemenis are making a living, transporting goods through donkeys. But food shortages, a sharp depreciation of the currency, and a lack of funds to pay public sector employees have plagued the port city.
It's time now for our in-depth section of this program. We're going to take a look at the numbers coming out of war-battered Yemen, which couldn't be more shocking, really. First, let's take a look at the population in that country. This is not a shock. The population has risen to 29.16 million, a little less than 30 million. Of course, there's been 300, 400, 500,000 maybe to have been killed as a result of the war. Now, in terms of the number of Yemenis that need urgent help, that amounts to 9.8 million. A little less than 10 million. Obviously, many Yemenis need basic health care, something that they can't have access to because of the bombing campaign that's happening. That number is 14.8 million people. That's almost half of the population, to put that into context for you. Now, as of April 12th, this is what Martin Griffiths, the UN special envoy for the country, has said, practically begging for the warring parties to seize opportunity for peace in the country.
The war in Yemen has lasted over 6 years. In these 6 years, Yemenis have increasingly and appallingly lacked access to food and medicine. More than 6 years with no basic services, with restriction of movement in and around and out of the country, and over 6 years of the children of Yemen being deprived of schooling and being deprived of their future. A generation has been lost.
Yeah, a generation lost indeed. Of course, you may be lost as a result of all the numbers that we are throwing at you. So let's do this. I want to put things into context for you and tell you, what if Yemen was 100 people? 100 people. And out of that, give you numbers out of 100 people as to the situation in Yemen. For example, the first item that we're going to take a look at would be humanitarian assistance, to make it simple. Out of each 100 people in Yemen, 74 would need humanitarian aid out of 100 people. Moving now next to having no access to clean water or sanitation services. The number of people that are in need of that are 57 out of 100. So you can see how severe these numbers are. Now, the next item that we're going to take a look at are people in Yemen who are food insecure and are at risk of famine. Here the number stands at 60 out of every 100 person in Yemen. of course, these numbers, again, are very shocking to put things into context for you. The next number is another shocking number when it comes to women. 10 of the women and children in Yemen are acutely malnourished. These numbers, such as this one, could actually now be more because the war is still ongoing. And finally, we're going to take a look at the figure that drove home the devastation of this war. You heard of the phrase in Yemen, how a child dies every 10 minutes. Why is a child dying every 10 minutes? The reason cited: malnutrition, diarrhea, and breathing infections. Now, does that give you a better idea? I hope so. Well, here is UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric on his latest look at the grave economic and humanitarian situation in that country.
Moving on to Yemen, our colleagues there tell us that the humanitarian situation continues to worsen, with fuel and food prices at double or even triple the pre-conflict averages, and the depreciation of the Yemeni rial, the threat of hunger for millions, is a reality.
Stefan Dujarric there, the UN spokesperson, who took a look at the grave economic situation in that country, not to mention, of course, the humanitarian situation. Now, we're going to bring in Mia Shua to get an analysis on that. Mia, welcome back. You are aware of the importance of Aden. So has Saudi Arabia and the UAE. They've set up a legitimate government there in their eyes. And we know that Aden is very important because most, if not all, goods that come through the country have to get distributed from there. But it's placed under a siege. What is your assessment of the situation of Aden and the embargo that both the Saudis and the Emiratis have placed there?
Yes, Saudi and its allies have the budget and the will to continue their campaign against a politically and economically independent Yemen. Aside from this, there is also the issue of Yemen's position at the gate of the Red Sea, a channel for Saudi exports and trade. Saudi is threatened by the idea of having a potentially powerful state on their southern border and controlling, maybe even policing, the Red Sea. This scenario would see Yemen carry a lot of leverage against their current aggressor. From this perspective, the Saudi coalition may prefer to continue their brutal campaign rather than face this difficult outcome of Yemeni control in the Red Sea.
Okay, thank you, Mia, for that. We do appreciate that. Now, we can cover the humanitarian figures of this war at length, but we also need to get a feel of some of the economic indicators, which also show how bad the economy is doing. Now, let's first take a look at how much money the country has lost in terms of its oil revenues. $75 billion is the figure that we have as of the latest figure for the loss of oil revenues. That figure, again, could be higher. The GDP is the next item. The cumulative GDP percentage contraction in real GDP terms came in at a whopping minus 50% for the year 2020. So half of the country's GDP to have been lost there. What does all of this translate into when it comes to economic loss as a whole? That's $88.8 billion. The war in Yemen has battered the economy there for 6 years, and it doesn't seem like it's going to stop anytime soon. What has fueled this war has been weapons, military equipment, sold mainly by the U.S. to Saudi Arabia and its allies. That has kept the war going on for 6 years now. But did you ever wonder why the war continues, even though Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to lose on the ground, like multiple attacks by the Yemeni army on Saudi's moneymaker Aramco and other military advances by the Yemeni army? Well, the reason is simple. Saudi Arabia is losing the war. It's spending a lot of money at it, too. And the Yemeni army wants to have a strong hand when it comes to the negotiations. That is why the Yemeni army is fighting to capture Ma'arib. That is the biggest district by area. Don't forget, the Saudis just recently offered a peace plan. It was rejected by the National Salvation Government because, well, it did not put an end to the blockade, which was a key demand of the government. U.S. support, once it ends, will wrap up the war. No doubt about that. But the question is there a strong enough will by the U.S. to give its order to Saudi Arabia to end the war? That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Vitali, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
in the limelight. Syria has condemned a Western-backed resolution passed by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, over the country's alleged use of toxic arms, saying the illegitimate move encourages foreign-sponsored terrorists to go ahead with their crimes in the Arab country. We now present you an article written by Robert Inlakesh, a journalist, writer, and political analyst who has written for publications such as Mint Press, Mondo Weiss, Memo, and various other outlets. The piece is titled, OPCW Ignores Critics of Its Cover-Up, Imposes Sanctions on Syria. Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, has revoked Syria's privileges at the agency, accusing it of repeatedly using chemical weapons during the war, yet refuses to properly address complaints of a cover-up by the organization over their sole underground investigation of any such attack. According to reports on the ground, on 7th of April 2018, an alleged chemical weapons attack was reported from inside Douma in Syria. Days later, the United States, Britain, and France bombarded Syria in response, without any clarification that any such attack had actually taken place. The significance of the alleged Douma attack was not only that it led to Western airstrikes on Syria, but also that it was the first alleged chemical attack that the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons had sent an underground team to investigate. Despite the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons now concluding that there was a chemical attack that took place, the leaked original report put together on the incident reveals that the studies conducted had found no evidence of a chemical attack using chlorine gas. Two whistleblowers also spoke out from inside the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, creating greater doubt about the credibility of the OPCW's publicly stated conclusions. A leaked engineering assessment conducted by the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons on the two gas cylinders found at the site of the alleged Douma attack interestingly found that the evidence had been tampered with. The first head of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, Khozeh Bostani, has also applied pressure and challenged the way the organization has handled the reporting, along with experts in the field such as Theodore Postol, an award-winning professor of science, technology and national security policy at MIT. Recently, award-winning investigative journalist Aaron Mate addressed the United Nations Security Council panel, laying out a detailed analysis which he says casts doubt over the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons' current position on whether there was a chlorine gas attack in Douma, Syria. When, at the end of the meeting, it came time for the representatives from both the United States and Britain to answer a direct question posed to them by journalist Aaron Mate, both representatives had already left the meeting. An EU lawmaker, Mick Wallace, was also attacked as having repeated fake news when he questioned the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons Director General Fernando Arias and said the following, "While we do not heed calls from renowned international figures to meet with all the investigators," he went on to state, "this problem is not going away. Are you going to investigate all aspects in a transparent manner?" It's safe to say that there are large question marks surrounding the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons findings, but what of those so-called moderate rebels in Syria, claiming to have witnessed the massacre of Syrian civilians with chlorine gas? The allegations of a Douma chemical weapons attack came from within territory held by a Saudi-backed terrorist group, the Al-Nusra Front. The terrorist organization, described as moderate rebels by Western media outlets, had a track record of placing innocent Syrian civilians, men, women, and children, in cages outside of areas where terrorists were stationed in order to deter airstrikes from Syria and Russian government, who wanted to free the cities from the clutch of these Takfiri terrorists. The group also had been accused of starving and brutally executing Syrian civilians, on top of shelling civilian neighborhoods under Syrian government control and filming themselves opening fire upon civilian airliners. At the time of the reported chlorine gas attack, it was clear that the Syrian government and their allies were on the verge of taking the rest of terrorist-held Eastern Ghouta. The claims of a so-called chemical weapons attack directly caused Western airstrikes, as happened just a year prior when a supposed chemical weapons attack also occurred in an area known as Khan Sheikhoun. There was clearly a motive for the terrorist organization, Al-Nusra Front, to claim that such an attack occurred in Douma, especially as they were losing the battle against Syrian government forces. In the case of the Syrian government, there would be no reason to risk committing such an atrocious crime when they were days away from complete victory, inviting Western airstrikes. This was simple to see with the most elementary level understanding of the Syrian war, yet these types of common sense arguments weren't even taken into account by the international community. Now, after ignoring